Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles Stories of the Supernatural. And the following is an interview that I did with Madeline Rudy and Merlin Wizard from the radio show Life in the Hologram. That's on kcoreradio.com. It was a great show. We spoke about a lot of interesting things, of course, having to do with the paranormal. I was with them and I joined, and one of those things, I liked their approach. They had a scientific approach before assuming it was a supernatural thing. So I worked both ends. I've worked from the scientific investigation part of it. I did a lot of pre-interviews. I would also do the follow-up, which was the actual investigation, if there was paranormal going on. I was reliable. And I hate to say this, but people don't realize that first of all, professional, because you're going into somebody's house and you're representing, even if it's a foundation. I was reliable, and I was, I'm bilingual, and also I was willing to travel a little bit if I could, if it was a couple of hours drive. So I was really good at filling in at the last minute if they had some member that had an emergency or couldn't make it. I was willing to travel. So I've been there for a really long time, and I worked with a lot of different groups. That was one thing I want to say about this foundation. Sometimes it was, they would even bring in other groups to work. So I got to know a lot of different groups. Some of them are still active, some of them are not. And again, you get known in the paranormal, what I call hardcore investigators. Okay, that there's very few hardcore investigators that have been around for a while that, despite what people think, have a higher standard as far as accepting that something is truly paranormal. How's that? I was working in this field before the advent of so many gadgets that they have now, that they have so many things. And even back then, we still caught a lot of before, I want to say there was photography, maybe face readings on temperature. You had EMF meters, which you have to be really careful with. That's why, I'll tell you what, people ask me, what's one of my best things that I work with? And I want to say my dowsing rods are, sometimes they can be slow, depending. But I want to say dowsing rods are one of my best methods of communications, or sometimes finding out if they've got portals. And mine are very basic. I have very basic dowsing rods that I've had. These I've had for like 15 years. So, and like all of these, all instruments that you work in this field with, they become attuned to you as far as how well they work with you. In other words, I learned how to ghost hunt basic. And then, of course, I've worked with a lot of investigations and teams where they have multiple cameras, all the gadgets, all the things to, for readings. I've worked all of that. I've seen that field grow. And the only thing I could say is I'm glad, because it's made it more mainstream and people are more willing to talk about their experiences. Like I tell them, I come from ghost hunting when the last thing a person wanted was a bunch of people to drive up in a van and a bunch of, spill out into the front lawn.
Yeah.
And have their neighbors go, oh, what's going on? It was like you had to be very discreet. Yes. The hospital. The only hospital per se, that I've gone to is the Trans-Allegheny, which of course was an asylum, which is a hospital. It's a hospital, but it's just for, I've been to Trans-Allegheny, which, this is the thing, absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, whenever you go to, whether it's these prisons or these asylums, I don't have to investigate them. I know that they're going to be haunted, just because there's a lot of people here that lived their entire lives there. This to them was home. And, because a lot of people always think of it as, oh, they were horribly treated, which in some cases, some of the practices they had were bad. And, again, it was because, this was before the advent of certain drugs. So the ways that they controlled their patients was horrid when we look at it. But besides that, people don't realize that there was people that they weren't really violent, but because of some type of mental disease they had, they lived their entire lives there. This was their home to them.
Yeah.
So the same way people haunt the house because that's where they lived, these people stay behind because this is what they knew as home, you know, whether it was the structure or the, you know, that they have a certain routine that they have to follow. This is, you know, that's, you know, but yeah, I went to Trans-Allegheny, which was very interesting. Obviously, it's very haunted, and I looked at some of the case studies of the some of the patients that they had that lived there for many years, and that was like a sampling. So, like I said, most hospitals and even modern hospitals, I tell people, hospitals, you know, regular are hotbeds of hauntings, and because you have a lot of people in hospitals that sometimes pass away and they are unaware that they passed away. They could be heavily medicated, sedation, you know, sedated. They could pass while they were being operated. They might have come in from some traumatic accident and they never regained consciousness, and they missed the transition part into the death state. So hospitals are very, very, just, you know, because everybody thinks of funeral homes and cemeteries sometimes, but hospitals, absolutely hospitals, are gonna have a lot of paranormal activity. And
Yeah, I would say so. I worked in a
oh,
hospital,
there you go. Yeah.
and my office was down from, like, it was on the fifth floor. So you got off the elevator and I had to make a left and another left. But this one room at the end of the
Yes.
floor, everybody died in that room. Man, that was the, I call it the one-way room.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
You went in, but you went out in a body bag.
Yeah. Isn't it weird how some rooms develop certain reputations? Yeah. And I have a cousin of mine who she was a nurse for like 40 something years, and she's told me stories, and I've had other people come up to me and tell me, especially people who work, I guess it's because it's just more noticeable work, like the overnight shift where things quiet down. They'll talk about seeing dark shadows or seeing certain things, going into certain rooms, and sure enough, this person will pass away. And of course, this is more common, you know, in either the ICU or the wings where they have people that are terminally ill. I had one gentleman tell me one time, he that one time they heard a woman scream, but like they were killing her, like a high-pitched scream, and it was him and another nurse at the nurse's station, and they looked at each other like, you heard, like, you know when people look at each other, and they knew he had already checked on the patients on that floor, and he went and he checked. And all the patients were fine. They couldn't account for it. And he says it was so clear that it was like this person was somewhere on that floor. It wasn't like something that happened somewhere else and they heard it like a muffled. It was a very clear woman screamed hard, like in pain, terror, that kind. And he just said he came back down and sat down next to the other nurse because she's told him, you go look. Why don't you check? You know, of course. I'll stay here, you know, make sure, you know, if any. And he says that, yeah, that happens on and off. And like exactly like what you said about that room. I heard about another room where the nurses, they would leave. There was this one bed. You know how some of these rooms have two beds? And you know they have the curtain that you know divides up for like a privacy curtain between one bed and the other. And they said there was this one bed that was next to the window, which this would be like the last bed that they would assign somebody to, because always funky things. They would see movement, like if the curtain was drawn around the bed, they would see movement of the curtain when there was nobody in the bed. And it wasn't so much where it was like what you described, this is the bed where everybody dies. It was because the nurses felt really weird going in there. And even when they were attending to a patient in the bed right next to it, they would hear like, you know, like really weird noises, or the flutter of that curtain. So it was like that room, and then if you had to give that room out, you would use the bed closest to the door, and then the last one, of course, would be that bed that they would assign to somebody.
Would you say though, like let's say somebody in the ICU and they had them like in an induced coma, or maybe they were just in a coma, that if there was some spirit that was marching around and decided, oh, look, here's something. I can get into this body here
I want to
and see what
say
happens.
this is, I hate to say this, but people don't realize that this is when an attachment can happen. And let me explain. Usually, if your aura is intact or in good shape, even if you have a discarnate, like exactly like what you described, somebody that died, and they either see somebody that they reminds them of their sister or something, whatever, or even like attract light, who knows, whatever. Usually, if your aura is intact, they could kind of try to, but it's like no way, no entry point. But the thing is that your aura will thin out from emotional and physical trauma.
Right.
Okay.
And
So another,
drugs.
oh, absolutely, drugs, without saying. But that's what I'm saying. Let's say you're not a person that normally does as engaged in risky behavior. By this, I mean drugs, heavy alcohol use. Something happens to you. You have a really bad accident, physical trauma. You're taken in there exactly like what you described. You're sedated because they put you in a coma for so you to recuperate. Yes, that does leave you vulnerable. It's not an absolute yes, but yes. That's why there's people that go into the hospital and then come out with an attachment. And then after they get well, like they go to their doctor and whatever was wrong with them, they'll develop other symptoms and then they'll go back to their doctor and the doctor is like, there's, you check out okay. But they'll have certain pain, certain symptoms. And what it is an attachment. And when I did my hypnotherapy practice, I came across some attachments that, when you start talking about the person as in, okay, when did you start experiencing this? You kind of trace it back. There's a good chance, not all the time, but the point of origin was after they had gone to the hospital, either for some type of surgery or they had had an accident, anything like that. And of course, this doesn't happen like overnight. You have to think about, man, when you start tracing back, well, when did I start feeling this? And that was a point. And then sometimes, you are able to have a dialogue with that spirit that's the attachment, which, by the way, once they become enmeshed at a certain level into your aura, they cannot get out. It's not like, oh, they got in. And then sometimes they do want out. Other times they feel comfortable with this person, whatever attracted them to that person. I've had instances where I've had nurses get attachments because, for some reason their aura had thinned out. And one of the discarnates I was walking around that maybe saw them as a very caring and nice person because they saw them going around in their duties. So they got an attachment just by being kind because sometimes that's the attraction. It could be as easy as that. Again, if your aura is intact and you have a spirit, they'll try to influence you. Influence is very different. Influence is when you get like a thought that you're like, what is that? I mean, where did that come from? But that's as bad as it gets. You yourself recognize. And after a while, they just go on their way because, like when you can't. When you're trying to open a package, and unless you can get like your little finger in there and pull, you can't. They'll circle around, and they just can't get into your aura, and then off they go. But the problem comes in again when your aura has holes in it, has thinned out, which could be for a variety of reasons.
Well, and couldn't that happen to you too? Like if you went into a crowd,
Yes.
I don't think people, they don't keep themselves aware enough to understand that this stuff is for real and it
Yes,
happens.
they do. And people don't realize, like what you just said, let's say you go someplace crowded. I was going to say malls, but malls aren't crowded anymore. Once upon a
No,
time, once upon a
lucky we
time, you
have
would go to
malls
the mall, it would
anymore.
be crowded, you know. But well, nowadays, all they have mostly at malls is theaters and you know, a movie theater and restaurants. But anyway, let's say any crowded venue. Same thing. Your aura is a little bit thin. Sometimes you have people, and I'm not talking here discarnate. You have, you know, people sometimes carry negativity with them, and it can jump ship on you. It can jump onto you. Okay, negative vibes, anger, depression, worry, anxiety. Everybody thinks of negativity only as in when we're talking a ghost. An attachment can be just negative energy. That's why sometimes, also depending on how sensitive you are or what's going on with you, they'll come home and they'll be like totally drained, like beyond, okay, you can get tired, but drained physically, mentally, or they'll feel upset or angry and they're like, what is going on? Why am I feeling like this? And sometimes the source of it is exactly what you described, Madeline, which is they go someplace, it's crowded, you really don't know who you're brushing up against or standing next to for a while. And things like that can jump on you. And I know that sounds a little bit dramatic, but yes, it's as easy as that. And again, the problem is the how well is your aura doing? Is it keeping, because that is part of the purpose of the aura, is to keep our metaphysical body, things like that, from penetrating and affecting you deeply.
Yeah, these are, things that you have to be aware of.
Yeah, yes, that's why I tell people, I have people that are police officers. A good friend of mine, she's, as a matter of fact, she's set to retire. I got her to the point where she carries a little smudge stick with her, and she would smudge down her car, like at the end of the shift, and herself before coming home, because stuff like that. Again, this might not have nothing to do with a discarnate, as in a spirit attachment. This just has to do with negativity, because maybe the line of work that you're in. You know, so something to keep in mind. I recommend doing it even at your home, at least once a month, that you sage down your house. If you're moving into a new place, absolutely. I recommend, as a matter of fact, my last book that I wrote, Supernatural Safety, I tell everybody, I don't care if where you're moving into, if it looks all either brand new or just paint, freshly painted, you know, everything is clean and it looks wonderful. Before you bring anything, you need to sage it down and possibly salt the corners, because you don't know. Let's take the ghost thing out of the mix. You don't know what was going on in that household. If there was dysfunction, was there a lot of arguments? You might even have people that there's certain sick rooms. Let's say somebody that was ill for a length of time, and they used a certain room for a length of time. By this, I don't mean like the cold. You know, I'm not talking about regular sickness. That I'm talking about a certain sick room that was in use.
Like somebody that had
Had
cancer or
cancer, had some type of illness that after a while, you know, they send them home. I've even, you know, even people, elderly, really elderly people, sometimes are suffering from dementia or, you know, symptoms of Alzheimer's, and they're given a certain room. That becomes woven in the fabric of that room, and if you don't do that, then the person occupying that room could experience some of the symptoms physically of whoever was there before, which is why I recommend it doesn't necessarily have to be just because it's haunted. It might not be haunted in the traditional sense of what we think of as haunted.
Yeah, it's just like filled with, let's say, negativity or.
Yeah. Yes, living the just the human condition. And again, this is not to make people paranoid, because what I'm talking, I would do it regardless, just to start off on a clean slate. I'm not talking about people having arguments. That's people argue. People get sick. You know, that's. I'm talking about something that's done over extended period of time. That's very negative, toxic, dysfunction. When you move into a new place, unless you know who absolutely was there before, you really have no idea. And again, you might know somebody, but sometimes you don't know what's going on in their private lives. So that's just for me, as far as being a little bit cautious. and a little bit of insurance.
Yeah, because I mean, when you say ghost and paranormal, that, you know, stretches a broad range of
Oh
things.
yes, absolutely. Yes, it does. And I'm sure you've heard of residual hauntings, which is, the haunting where they say, okay, this is not an intelligent haunting. It's just like a loop, something that was done. Let's say you'll smell baking bread very early in the morning, or certain steps, like if it's an older house and people going up and down the stairs at certain times. And really, there's no intelligence. It's just like a loop, something that was done so many times. Well, it's kind of a version of a haunting, but I want to say, like, a residual haunting is even better than this type of haunting, which in a way is a haunting of the emotion, the human emotion. That's again why people will go to battlefields, and you have the haunting of sometimes the actual battle or soldiers that died there, and then you have the feelings of the people that lived there or died there, even though they might not be there, but their emotions imprinted. Can you imagine hundreds or sometimes thousands of people, being shot at or shooting and or dying or seeing somebody next to them shot? I mean, that ground is so heavily imprinted with emotion. Well, it's a version of that on a smaller scale when you go into certain houses or apartments. Again, you never know what's there. Better to be, what's that saying, safe than sorry?
Yep. Well, I know I've been up to Gettysburg a couple of times, and a lot of people were killed there.
Yes.
And even when you go in this one room, it's like a 365 degree picture they had on the wall. And then they play all this music and whatever, and the cannons and the guns are going. I stood there and cried. It's like, oh my God, get me out of here.
Right. Yes. I've been to Gettysburg a couple of times, and when you go now, it's very scenic with all these, memorials and stuff, and of course the fields. And I know that they have reenactments, but when you look at that, it's kind of like, it's sometimes people have a hard time thinking what happened here when people were shooting and trying to kill each other, and everything was full of blood and cannon fire and people screaming because their leg got blown off. I mean, sometimes you have to think beyond what you're just seeing with a memorial.
Yeah, well, there some guy in front of you with a gun, and the gun, and it's whoever shoots first is the one that's going to live, unless another shot gets you from someplace else.
Right,
Because
and
they didn't, I mean, unless they, I'd have been behind a rock.
That's the thing, my
For
God, those
me.
musket balls, and you knew the medical care that you were going to get if,
Oh,
sometimes if
well.
it wasn't the bullet that got you, the musket ball, it was, and unfortunately, sometimes the medical care they had, that was,
Wasn't, I mean, they just chopped your arm off. They like sawed it off.
and that was just hoping to save you. And yeah, because they were sending, how many surgeons did they have sometimes out there? They weren't adequately staffed.
No, that was Gettysburg, and I mean some of those buildings in, I have a picture of the one place that I had lunch in, and you can see like a shadow, a ghost in there.
Well, absolutely, and there's a little, in other words, there's also, I think there's also stuff that goes on by the people that live there, because you always think of the war, but think about the people that live there. Can you imagine living and in a battlefield once they left, and you had bodies laying out there? That must have been a horrible place to live. Think about it, here you, because let's face it, like I tell them,
Even now.
yeah, I know there's still, every once in a while they do find some type of, they run across different type of paraphernalia, stuff that's in the ground, and but yeah, imagine living there if you lived in Gettysburg. And after those 3 days, what it must have been like to live there.
Yeah, that must, well, it had to be horrible.
Yes, yes.
And they didn't even know about post-traumatic stress syndrome.
No, it was back then, it was like, what you know, what the English, what the Brits say, stiff upper lip. It was like, you roll with it.
Yeah.
Stiff upper lip.
Yes, there, we got a Brit there. Yes.
I'm Brit.
Just not cricket.
But yeah, that was that. How you handled it. It was like, oh, we don't have time for this. And to be honest, back then also, anything having to do with mental health carried a lot of stigma with it. So the last thing you were going to admit to was that you were reliving, you were having to run into a closet because you were reliving a wartime episode or something like that. You just like, last thing you wanted to do was be sent to a sanitarium or an asylum. So. Yeah, you dealt with it, in other words. But, yeah, there's a lot of places like that, unfortunately, that we look at a present day, and as much as we want to envision it, it's kind of hard to see how terrible it must have been when those events were occurring.
Yeah, politics of the time.
Like,
well, it's hard to envision as an American having to have war on your back on your front doorstep.
Marlene, our listeners get to buy your books and
watch your movies? You can go to MarlenePardo.com or MiamiGhostChronicles.com. As far as you can buy the books. You also have links to everything else. I'm on Amazon. All my books are on Amazon. But if you want to see, what's out there as far as the podcast or anything of that nature, MiamiGhostChronicles.com or MarlenePardo.com. And as a matter of fact, I'm about to release my first fiction book because I've put out 3 nonfiction books, which I'm planning to make into a series. And that's about to be released, at least on the Kindle version, and then maybe in about 2 weeks the print version, which is like horror fantasy fiction book. I don't know whether to put in the horror or the dark fantasy or the supernatural category, kind of that kind of mix. That's the subject on the book that's about to come out, which is titled Walker Between the Worlds. Book one of the Civil Chronicles. But again, anything else, those are the 2 websites. Or if you go to Amazon, you can visit my author's page at Marlene Pardo Pelliser. I have an author's page also on Amazon.
Sounds interesting, huh?
Okay. I hope.
The book sounds interesting.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I've always been interested in writing, but again, there's a difference between writing nonfiction when we're talking here purely research and facts, or if you're just putting in your input as far as your knowledge is concerned, versus going into the fiction realm, especially something that we're talking here, let your imagination loose as far as the subject matter and to come up with ideas and characters. Yeah, there's a big difference. So. Or sometimes people think, oh, well, I've got this great idea for this book or this story. And then when it comes to putting it and getting it from the head out through your fingers, and then that's hard. Writing is hard, but I think that writing fiction is harder than writing nonfiction. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, because you have to get, if you have, I guess, less characters is better.
Well, it's just to make it, it's like what make it the dialogue, that stuff called grammar, punctuation, things like that. That is also, it's like, oh yeah, this is the way I want to say it. But then when you put it on paper, it's like, wow, that doesn't sound right. When you read it back to yourself. So yeah, you have like a learning curve there as far as, or you don't know as much grammar as you thought you did because it's like, oh, so That's what they mean by the conjunction when all that other stuff is like, oh my God. So, yeah. And when you're at this point where I'm doing a lot of my self-editing, I'm doing as far as, you know, the spell check. And not only the writing, I guess. I'm doing also the behind the scenes. I have my son that he's doing some of the editing for me because he's got a master in fine arts as far as writing is concerned. But still, I'm not being, I don't got a bunch of people behind me doing all that drudge work.
Yeah, I guess. And you have to be a pretty good proofreader.
Yes, you do.
Because I even see in a lot of different books where there's some errors. And I'm not even that good of a proofreader.
Yes, people don't realize how easily stuff slips by. You miss a little word, like a two-letter word, like if, of, or your punctuation's off, or something is missed. It could slip by very, very easily. That's why you really, that takes a lot of, it's drudge work, it's drudgery, because you have to be very concise. You're reading it not for the read part, but for the checking part. And it can be very tiresome, but hey, love of your craft. So that's when you really know, do I really love it? this is when you really find out as far as being a writer, if you really love your craft.
Well, now, the hypnosis, did that help you at all with some of these different things that you did?
Hypnosis, people, you know, I had a lot of people that come to me, of course, for regular stuff, the stop smoking, you know, they had weight issues, a lot of things. And then I did also alternative areas of hypnosis, which was spiritual attachment, age regression, past life regression. I did some work with... you know, abductees, you know, had you have, you know, extra contact with extraterrestrials, things of that nature. But I will tell everybody, hypnosis, the best thing about hypnosis is relaxation, stress relief. A lot of my clients, I would give them like a very short MP3 file for them to listen, just to relax. And a lot of them would tell me, you know, I keep on using it. I go to sleep with your recording. Because people don't realize that because of our lifestyle, we get into... By this, I'm not saying somebody that's anxious. This is just regular everybody. We get sometimes between either our lifestyle or stuff that comes up, our work demands, we get anxious. And just the fact, if you can de-stress, bring down your stress levels, everything else becomes so much better. We don't realize how much even minimal stress that we carry in our subconscious mind affects us, affects the quality of our life. So I tell everybody, hypnosis, just to de-stress, that right there is, people should do it once a week. If they could do it every day, I urge them sometimes even, you know, a lot of, you know, you've heard about people doing affirmations. The best time to do an affirmation is before you go to sleep. This is when the filter between your conscious and your subconscious mind will drop. And when you welcome and are willing to change for new ideas or affirmations that you're doing. I know a lot of people do it when they wake up, which is fine. But as far as it becoming accepted into your subconscious mind, it's that period right before you're falling off to sleep. And of course, you relax. And the quality of your sleep also is much better. It will allow you to go down into REM sleep, which is very, very important as far as resting your mind and having, this is when your subconscious talks to you, when you're in REM. That's sometimes, if you remember, not everybody remembers the dreams. This is when you have those really wild dreams with weird animals, weird people, weird circumstances, places that you're like, what is this? That is your subconscious talking to you. Your subconscious talks to you in symbols. And you achieve that when you drop down into REM, into the REM level. And as a matter of fact, when I would hypnotize my clients, that's one of my suggestions to them, was that they would fall off to deep sleep and go into REM level sleep. Because this is what would allow them to clear out what they were doing during the daytime. All the running around and just either you know, either throw it away, you know, stuff that didn't matter, and would give you a clear mindset when you woke up in the morning to ready to take on the day. So yeah, stress relief is very important, and hypnosis is very good for that, as far as every day we use it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and you gotta straighten out your mind and your thoughts.
Well, we are so inundated, you know, modern times, we get so inundated with messages constantly, whether we're listening to the radio, the TV, multitasking, because we're trying to do 100 things at once, you know, our phones. Tell everybody, you know, nowadays you're supposed to be instantly available to whoever's calling you, even family members. They call you and you don't answer. And the next thing you do is you get a text message like, why didn't you answer the phone? I was calling you. All those things contribute to, and by this I don't mean there's a problem, but the anxiety that on demand that you're supposed to always be there. Let's not even go into the job. You know, now, you know, you're supposed to be instantly available even if you're on the road. That builds up as far as all the stuff that we get thrown at us. And there's has to be a point where you totally de-stress and put that away. Because if not, it kind of builds. If you don't do that, then the next day you're dragging stuff from all your prior days. Which is, of course, and I'm sure you've heard of it, those people that have tried to do that, that not too intelligent, you know, go without sleep. How long can I go without sleeping? And then some of them have been affected permanently. Their brain is altered. Again, it's just not the sleep part. It's the quality of your sleep, relaxation, REM sleep. All of that's very important.
Yeah, because you can be sleeping, but you're not sleeping.
Oh, of course not. Of course. And I tell everybody, I remember when I was a teenager, you could basically run a locomotive through my room. And I wouldn't wake up. I remember my mom on purpose would start vacuuming outside my room, you know, and I knew this was her trying to get me up. Once you had kids, forget it. I don't think I've ever slept the same before because, you become like a hyper, you want to listen. But again, there's got to be an in-between, which is the I listen to every noise versus I'm dead to the world. And that's why. And again, some people are good 4 hours of sleep and they're good to go. As long as those four hours were deep, they're good. And then you've got the people that need the 10 hours or the 12 or the 8. Everything. It's just that whatever it is that you need, it's good. That's what's important. That whatever amount of time you put into your sleep, you let your body totally relax and your mind follows and clears out, and your subconscious mind clears out. And again, then we come, you know, like I said, if you're working on any affirmations, especially life-changing affirmations, people don't realize that we, by our nature, are very resistant to change. And usually our subconscious, regardless if your conscious mind thinks it's a great idea, whatever the affirmation might be, our subconscious mind will fight it, even though it might be a beneficial change, because we strive to stay in our comfort zone, which is what we know. Even that's why you know, and this has happened to myself, you're resistant to going to the gym, to walking, to losing weight, to changing your diet. We sometimes are resistant to changing jobs. People sometimes will stay in positions or in companies, even if they maybe know I could make more money or I'm worth more money, because they are afraid of the change. And they talk themselves out of it. And I say this, when you start doing something, or you know when you go into a new job or you go someplace new that you don't know anybody and you have this feeling of discomfort, like, I want to go back home. That's okay. That's good, because you're basically pushing against your discomfort zone. And then, guess what? You stay there and 1 week goes by, 2 weeks go by, 3 weeks go by before you know it. But a lot of people run out or don't even want to feel that feeling of discomfort because they don't want to they're afraid of what is the unknown. And your subconscious, by the way, will sabotage you in the sneakiest ways to keep you in that circle of what is comfortable and known. And sometimes very bad for you, depending on what it is that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So.
That's for sure.
Yes. We are creatures of habit more profoundly than people realize.
Yeah. That's for sure, isn't it? When you watch people, what their daily routine is.
Yes. And don't get me wrong. Stability is good for human beings. That there's nothing wrong with it. It's when we need to make beneficial changes that it becomes a problem.
Yeah, because sometimes we don't want to change.
Oh, no. Or sometimes we do want to change. We do want to change, but we are subconscious is going, no. No, no, no.
Not today.
Not today. Not tomorrow. Not the day after either. You're going to stay right where you are. We know what this is about.
And yeah. Marlene, give your information again about your books and things so our listeners, and you have a lot of different documentaries, don't you, on Netflix and
right, well,
you
were
the Travel Channel and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they can go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com or MarlenePardo.com if they want information on any of the shows or my books. But back in 2017, I was in season one, episode one of Paranormal Survivor. This is for a vehicle, which, by the way, we still have, which is which was Haunted Objects, but it was a muscle car that my husband bought. 1980s IROC Camaro, one of those muscle cars, and turned out to have a very bad attachment. We still have a car, and that's what that. And then on this other show that just aired a few months ago, which is season one of Haunted Hospitals, because I was an investigator for the state, and it features one of the stories that I did. An experience I had as an investigator for, because I used to work the weekend and we had which by the way, when you work investigations, nobody works on the weekends as far as, all the periphery that has to do with either the courts or anything like that. And, we would take turns being on call. This would be for either very serious cases that couldn't wait till like 7 a.m. the following day when we would come back on for regular cases. So we would have a rotating wheel as like, okay, you're on call, which is something that came in after 11 p.m. So this is an experience I had for a child death when I was doing the investigative work. And it was very unusual. I mean, I had a lot of experiences during the time that I did it. And again, like a lot of, because, you know, sometimes we see a lot of these shows are people purposely looking to have the encounter with a ghost or something. And sometimes it doesn't happen that way. Sometimes it's when you're not looking for it that things happen. And as a matter of fact, you don't want it to happen. And that show that last one came out from Haunted Hospital that deals with that event about an experience I had during that investigation, that case.
Interesting.
Yes. And it was a very... And it's really funny because towards the end of the show, you know, that episode, you know, that portion, they asked me, did you put that in your report? And I said, absolutely not. You couldn't put that because, of course, your investigation is going, it's part of a case. You could go, it's forensic evidence. You might need to go to court on it. You could never put that on there because that's it. Your credibility is shot. And, I hate to say it, this is the truth. You'll have judges looking, you know, after a while, you have judges and certain attorneys that work in that court system who know you. And if you develop a good reputation, that's good. But the last thing you want to do is develop a reputation for being that investigator. So of course I wouldn't, and I wouldn't taint an investigation, especially something along as serious as that, with my own personal experiences. So yeah, then that, and a lot of people out there in different areas of work, I know for a fact have had similar, not exactly that, but have experiences that you'll never see them documented, because precisely because of that reason. Because not only is it a career killer in some instances, if your credibility is part of what you do for a living, you don't want to damage that in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, because people will start to think you're nuts.
Well, it's just, it doesn't, you know, because part of investigations, if you're an investigator, you're supposed to be dealing strictly with facts, with your observations, if you're collecting information, data, whether it's interviews, reports, paperwork, photography, whatever it entails, but it's fact-based. You're not supposed to put your opinions, much less like, hey, I think I'm having a paranormal experience. That doesn't work. Doesn't work. Believe me, doesn't work at all.
What's the spookiest thing that ever happened to you?
As an investigator?
Yeah.
I want to say one time I was, I had gone to, because I worked, when you get called out, you could go to any hospital because, you know, emergency rooms are open 24/7. And a lot of these places, you go in the daytime and they're perfectly normal looking. Go back out at 3 a.m. and everything changes. And I had to go to one of the main hospitals here in Miami, which is a very large hospital. And how can I say it? I had what I thought was, I want to say the first time it looked like a shadow person to me. And my first impression was, am I being followed? Because it's in this area of town where you have a lot of vagrants and people that wandering around. It doesn't matter to them. It's 2 or 3 in the morning. But I was used to that. I didn't have a problem with it. But first of all, you start getting those weird feelings. And my car's parked out there. There's not that many vehicles. Because of course staff, hospital staff, they have a separate parking lot for where they park at. And I was like, wow, I'm getting that. I'm getting looked at feeling. And then, you know, I see, you know, there's not that many cars, but there are some cars. I saw what looked like a shadow. And my first thing is, I'm getting followed. Because, you know, that hood that you know, a lot of people now wear that hood thing over, like if they have a hoodie on, they'll wear the hood on. So I didn't immediately jump to the conclusion of a shadow person. And then I was seeing it, all of a sudden I'm seeing it like dark behind, like I saw it behind one vehicle and I'm like, okay. And all of a sudden I see it, but closer, I'm thinking, okay, that's the first moment I had where there's no way that was a human being. It could go from over by that car to over here by this car with me not seeing anybody. So I went from being not kind of alarmed, not really, because I did that so often, to, okay, this thing is coming closer and this is not a regular live human being. And what's really funny is that happened to me on more than one occasion in the same parking lot of that hospital. Which, by the way, that hospital was a hospital which was one of the few that would welcome, they would fly in traumas, really bad accidents would be taken there. So it had, usually, it would see a fair share. As a matter of fact, a portion of it would also treat prisoners, people that were, you know, that were going to go to prison, or, yeah, that they would take them there and check them out. So they had a lot of in and out as far as people are concerned. And I had that experience. I would always, the few times I had it, it was always in the parking lot of that particular hospital. And as far as I'm concerned, the feeling I got, because it was a shadow being, it wasn't like, oh, it's scary, it's a shadow person, is the feeling that came with it, which was a very dreadful feeling, a very negative. And I don't mean that like, oh, scary. I'm scared. It was like dreadful, as in negative. That whatever was out there, and which when I thought about it later on, and it's one of those things that it was like, you know, I need to get in my car and leave. Like I mean that's exactly what I would do. I would zoom out of there because of the feeling that I was getting of those encounters. And I'm, like I said, I've done a lot of investigations for the years of paranormal events. And I'm not going to say I don't get startled, but when my kids were teenagers, I would take them on a couple of my investigations, and they would tease me because they would say, "Mom, you know, people are running in the other direction, and you're the one that's going, look, you know, oh, did you see that?" They would be like, "Mom, we got to go." So what I'm saying is, even I have that first startle, if that's what I'm looking at. So for me to say I'm leaving, I got to leave, like now, is because I recognized I'm not going to stand here and try to do an investigation on shadow people. And again, it's because there's a spiritual turbulence that sometimes surrounds some of these places, just because the flow in and out of humanity is that. It attracts that. It just... You realize that this is not a wandering spirit of somebody that happens to be just, you know, lost, like a human soul, I guess, your regular mm-hmm. dead person kind of thing. It's definitely something negative, and I didn't want to like have anything to do with it, none whatsoever. Again, that's one of those things. Also, a lot of my investigations, sometimes I would go into parts of town that were questionable. I saw a lot of things dart in and around buildings that were high crime areas, for lack of a better word. They were high crime areas. And I saw a lot of things. I saw dark shadows and things that I want to say that the shape of them were not entirely human, jump from balconies to one balcony or jump and go, you know, behind a building. I've seen that. The best way I could describe it is that we're talking here non-human entities. And I'm not going to use the D word. I'm not going to go with the demon thing, which I think is overused and, you know, overdone. But there's a lot of other things besides demons that exist. And I want to say, unfortunately, they are attracted again to places where there's crime going on, sometimes heavy drug use. The people that live or wander in that area, they're up to stuff, you know, mental illness, or they're involved in crime and criminal activity. That creates, like, I want to say, like a vortex of spiritual turbulence that these creatures are attracted to. And I saw that a lot. Especially at nighttime. And by this, I don't mean maybe those things were present in the daytime. It's just that they were more noticeable.
Right. Well, everything, the whole landscape changes in the night.
Yes, it does. It does. I've been in apartment buildings where I've been sitting and interviewing somebody, and I hear somebody coughing. And you know how some of these apartments buildings, they have really thin walls, like, and it's been like one of these like two plate, you know, like a duplex, like it's just on two units. And I've made a comment, you know, like, oh, that person next door, because they've been consistently coughing. And I've said, boy, your neighbor's got coming down with something. And they've told me, no, nobody lives next door. Yeah. And I'm like, what? And then they look at me like, yeah, we hear it all the time too. I took it in stride thinking that it's their neighbor coughing a lot. Until I even made the comment, wow, that person sounds really sick. It sounds like they're coming down with something. And then they look at me and they're like, no, that there's nobody living. That place is empty.
Hmm. Now, what was the first investigation you ever went on?
As far as for what, for paranormal investigations?
Right, right.
God.
Or ghost hunting, or...
Let me think a minute. Oh, that's a good one. I can't remember exactly the first one, but I remember we did one once, which was, as a matter of fact, I want to say it was close to where you used to live at, close to Delray. It was up there in that area, or Vero Beach. It was in that area. Mm-hmm. And this was a lady, she lived, her husband had, it was, she lived in a house with her husband. She had started experiencing some hauntings. And she had lived for a few years in this house, had not had any experiences. Her husband dropped dead of a heart attack. He just dropped dead on the in their Florida room, what they call the Florida room here in Florida. Mm-hmm. And he was dead. So, like all things, when something like that happens, everybody wants to point the finger at the recently deceased person, thinking that's the cause, that's the origin. I remember we went in there, and what we picked up on was they had lived there for a few years, but the house, I want to say, was maybe built like in the 1950s. And it turned out that there was this one room opposite. But at this point, she was living by herself in the house. There was this room that was opposite to where she slept in, which was the master bedroom, which is full of energy. It turned out that what was in there was the ghost of a little boy that had been abused. And this, his sanctuary was his room. There was some type of physical abuse going on with his child, and he was still there. And he had stayed there because his bedroom was like his sanctuary, his place to be safe. And it was something that we weren't prepared for, like I said, because the usual suspect is the husband who died suddenly. You know, the one that you always think that's the one that's going to be haunting. He wasn't there. Mm-hmm. He was gone. He was fine. In other words, he, even though he might have dropped dead, he was out of here. He was out of there. It was the child. It was
enough of those crap.
Yeah. And I remember that's what's one of the ones that stuck out, because again, when you do paranormal investigations, you cannot go always with the expected person or identity that you're thinking is going to be the one, the mm-hmm. obvious one. And if you're an investigator, you always leave the door open. Yeah, you might have that one. I'm not saying not, but there's always a possibility that there is something else there that is keeping a low profile. And that was also part of that haunting that this child kept as a spirit, as a ghost, kept a very low profile. It didn't want to leave. It the way it protected itself when that child was alive was almost like disappearing into their room. I don't want to, you know, I want to keep a low profile, so that, because it was an abuse that was happening from somebody that lived in that house with them. So this is the way it kept doing what it was doing in life, mm-hmm. which was to not be out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. And that was one of the first that I did, that I can remember, because I've done a lot. I've done Madeline. I've done so many cases.
I'm sure.
And sometimes it's people, I'm going to say that a lot of people also bring in, because especially here in South Florida, they dabble. And then some, and I'm going to say dabbling, people dabble wherever you live, but here in South Florida, they dabble in stuff that they shouldn't have. They've gone sometimes to some of these Santeria or voodoo, just out of curiosity. You know, they go to, and they don't understand that in the practice of this, they use discarnates for divination purposes. And they will have a lot of discarnates sometimes hanging around. And they can pick stuff up also, and in the sense of that they didn't move into the haunted house. They went somewhere and picked something else, and then the haunting, they brought it home. Again, also the thing with cemeteries here, it's very easily find discarded ritual objects in cemeteries. There's also something, a phenomenon people are not aware of, which are called cemetery sentinels, which are non-humans. That's a big problem if you run afoul of something like that. These are beings that are attracted because there's a certain amount of mourning, of anguish, usually you'll get that as a cemetery starts growing. So they can be, the people, they can be placed there. They can be invoked and placed there. But sometimes they're attracted after the cemetery gets X amount of burials. And then there's just, and it's an active cemetery, in other words. Certain amount of burials, certain amount of people going there, either initially at the burial or when they come back to visit a grave. If you start, especially people that go in there, not the people that go in there to visit their loved ones, it's the people that go into cemeteries and they desecrate. They're asking for, if there is a cemetery sentinel, I don't know how else to say it. They have no idea what they're letting themselves in for. Or they take things, because this is not, if you get an attachment from a cemetery sentinel, this is not a question of, because this is almost, I want to say, on the level of an elemental. This is not a question of an exorcism. This is a question of breaking the ties between you and this thing. You can't really exorcise it. It's not trying to possess you in the sense of what we think of a possession. It's just that you're in its crosshairs and it's trying to punish you. And you got to break the connection. And an elemental doesn't have a moral compass the way we as humans see it. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. It's not love. It's hate. It's not bargaining. It's just, so sometimes people have a hard time understanding what they're dealing with. It's breaking the connection. That's why I'm saying when people sometimes are going to cemeteries, and I've done it myself for investigations, besides, you know, what you might run into there, I tell people, sometimes people will dispose, either they do rituals in the cemetery, or they will dispose of materials inside cemetery grounds. Because, you know, sometimes some type of rituals involves using cemetery dirt, or they're invoking or using a discarnate, and they leave it behind in the cemetery, like, so it won't follow them home. So sometimes you will have spirits inside cemetery grounds that not necessarily were buried there. Or people, I've gone to cemeteries, and if you can't get into the cemetery ground, you go around the periphery, depending where it's at, and you will find candles, you know, burnt out candles, stuff that's been used. And you might look at it, and I've seen Bibles that have been like, that you could tell they were part of ritual use. And a lot of things in and around cemeteries, besides the regular old dead person that's buried there and just hasn't figured out they're dead, or they're just stuck by their body trying to figure out like what happened. There's a lot of darker stuff that comes with what.
Yeah, I was down in Louisiana. Where is it that they have the Mardi Gras?
Yeah, New Orleans.
Right. And they have cemetery tours.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, I don't know.
That was a big mistake.
I haven't been to New Orleans, I want to say, since like a long time ago. I want to say since like 1990. I haven't been to New Orleans. And I know that the cemeteries, you know, everything is above ground over there. And I know that some graves, like Marie Laveau's and everything, you've got people, but I guarantee you that people go in there to do some stuff. I don't know how, I don't know if they're more careful now. You know, like lately, a lot of cemeteries now, they don't let people in like after a certain time.
Right.
But historically, yeah, have cemeteries were known for the place to do certain rituals and spell work and just
like
because.
Birkin Hare. Yes. My Birkin Hare in London used to take the bodies and sell them to surgeons for
there you go.
Cadaver.
Yes.
Cadaver explorations.
And people don't realize now it's more difficult, but use body parts from a live person for necromancy. It's not necessary. You know, you always think always of like the medical, like what you were talking about Merlin, about the, you know, the grave robbers, as far as using the bodies for anatomy courses.
Yeah.
There's a thriving trade with human body parts or humans because for dark ritual magic.
On that point, Marlene, I have to cut you off because it's the end of the show.
It's okay.
It went so quickly, and we really enjoyed your information on all these different ghost stories and things, and I'm sure our listeners have. So thank you very much for being on the show. Thank you, Merle.